of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
These
descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, November 21st, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Getting steamed to overcome corporatism. Ralph Nader on his newest book. Plus writer and activist Brian Dominic on tactics of violence versus nonviolence in the Occupy movement. And why the Stop Online Privacy Act is being dubbed the Internet Blacklist Bill.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The deadline for the Congressional Supercommittee to outline cuts in the federal budget is today, and an announcement is expected at any time that the 12-member bipartisan group has failed to come to consensus. This means that the $1.2 trillion of automatic cuts are slated to happen, affecting Medicare, the military, and other programs. That's going to be triggered as per the debt ceiling bill that was enacted and passed in late summer. But some Republicans are scrambling to prevent cuts to the Pentagon, leaving only domestic social safety net programs on the chopping block. Democrats say they won't let that happen. Meanwhile, popular sentiment against skyrocketing income inequality, as manifested in the Occupy Wall Street movement, continues to rise. On Sunday, Zuccotti Park in New York, where overnight camping is now prohibited, saw a gathering of immigrant Spanish-speaking women who declared solidarity with the Occupy movement. Elders from the civil rights movement also addressed Occupy protesters at a local church, and a drum circle protest was carried out in front of New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's private mansion. Most notably over the weekend, Occupy protesters and students at UC Davis protesting fee hikes were pepper sprayed in the face by police while they were sitting down with linked arms. A video of the incident has gone viral and resulted in the UC Davis police chief being placed on leave. And Occupy Los Angeles and Occupy Oakland have planned to shut down all ports on the West Coast on December 12th. We turn next to a man who has been a stalwart defender of the 99% for decades. Ralph Nader is a longtime consumer advocate, presidential candidate, and author. His 1965 book, Unsafe at Any Speed, led to vast improvements in automobile safety. His latest book is called Getting Steamed to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. The book is a compilation of corporate misdeeds throughout the year 2009 with pointed commentary by Nader. In his introduction, Nader writes, quote, "The aggregation of these corporate outrages can spark your conscience and stiffen your resolve to speak out with other Americans or support much greater reforms and law enforcement against corporate crimes." Ralph Nader now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Ralph Nader.
Thank you, Sonali.
So in your book, you say you're conducting a sort of experiment that's based on generating a sort of moral indignation, which you say informed indignation among the public who reads your book, so that when they read enough stories of corporate misbehavior, it could generate or spark action. What do you sort of mean by informed indignation?
Well, you know, corporate abuse is everywhere, and it's reported everywhere, but you hear about it one at a time, and it's hard to recall. So what I did in this book was take about 200 cases of corporate abuses in the health insurance rackets and the financial and the product defects and corruption of government and tax haven and all the kind of mainstream reporting. In Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, and also from the Corporate Crime Reporter and other smaller publications. And I summarized them with my commentary so that you have most of them are less than one page. And so here's the experiment. In the introduction, I say to people, get ready for this experiment. and I asked him a question. When you read about an injustice by a corporation against a patient, consumer, worker, taxpayer, community, do you, like most people, recoil with dismay or disgust and then return to your workaday world? And do you react that way because you don't have the power to do anything about it? And say, all right, just take a few hours and go through this small book, reading one outrage after another. And then at the end, read the aftermath. And the aftermath basically says, are you ready for action? Well, here you are with fresh memories, what you just read, pretty rotten abuses, eh? But we've got the power to stop these big corporations from running this country into the ground.
And you essentially cite examples of corporate malfeasance from 1 year alone.
Yes, just 1 year, 2009, just to show that, you know, we're not picking from a 20-year span, the worst ones. It's chronic. It's continual. These corporations are recidivists. Even in the rare instances when they're caught and prosecuted, they keep doing it, just like Wall Street now is still messing around with these very risky derivatives, using other people's money. So the important thing is how people react. Now, I say, okay, if you're steamed, and I use the word steam because in the physical world, you know, steam powers turbines, which produce electricity, which in turn produces light. And so I say getting steamed to overcome corporatism, and that's what the big problem is in this country. That's what's keeping solutions on the shelf, from energy to health care to community economics to clean government. And so I say, okay, if you're steamed enough, here's the offer. And the offer is, a lot of people don't want to pledge time and money to a national movement to subordinate corporate power to the sovereignty of the people, unless they know others are going to do it. So on page 187, I basically have four little squares. So I say, okay, will you pledge at least 100 volunteer hours and to raise or contribute $100 for coordinated fundamental corporate reforms and self-initiatory power for the people to protect themselves? When you are directly informed that 999 other Americans have signed the same pledge, or you might want to check the box when you are directly informed to your satisfaction that 9,999 other Americans have signed the same pledge, or if you want to wait further, 99,999, and then the final one is 999,999,000. In other words, we're looking for 1 million Americans to put funds on the line, to put their time in a coordinated type of drive on Congress and other institutions to solve this problem constitutionally and statutorily once and for all, namely, corporations are not persons. They're not human beings. They must be subordinated to the sovereignty of the people in all kinds of ways.
Well, let's give our listeners a taste of some of these instances of corporate crime. Perhaps even aggregating a few of them in a short interview might give them a taste of getting steamed. In your book, you have so many examples, one of which is the pharmaceutical industry's selling of drugs that they are essentially know to be dangerous or just are not tested very well, with the collusion of government. Among them, things like hormone replacement therapy, but even other more recent drugs. How is this allowed to happen? How can the pharmaceutical industry keep manufacturing drugs for the public that that have endangered Americans and even caused death?
Well, first of all, they fund the Food and Drug Administration's budget to monitor them, and they fund members of Congress to make sure that the Food and Drug Administration doesn't have the resources sufficient to crack down. That's one. The second is, these drug companies always keep one step ahead of the federal cops on the corporate beat. So they will sell a drug for an approved use, but then on the side, they'll push for off-label approval to market it, which is a crime. And they've been caught a couple times and had to pay $600-700 million. And then there are other drugs that actually are inadequately tested. After they sell them, they get clinical reports showing, hey, you're not preventing heart attacks with this drug. You're creating heart attacks with this drug. Just the opposite.
And in your comment on this story, you say there are about 100,000 Americans who die every year from adverse reactions to the effects of approved prescription drugs. Just an amazing number. A lower number than that is the number of Americans who die every year because they don't have health insurance. And the whole health reform debacle that resulted in the very weak bill that President Obama passed, and the fight over that is some indication of how health insurance companies have a hold on the economy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, 100,000 people lose their lives because of adverse effects of drugs in this country. That's 2,000 a week. Now, just consider that's close to 300 a day.
Wow.
And in 10 days, that's equivalent to the massacre on 9/11, and it's every 10 days. And there's just so much more. The gouging, the price gouging by these tax-subsidized and research-transmitted drug companies. I mean, they get a lot of their research and clinical studies free from the National Institutes of Health, like Taxol, a major anti-cancer drug, was developed with $31 million taxpayer dollars by the National Cancer Institute and given free to Bristol-Myers Squibb, who then turns around and in a letter I got 10 years ago from a 50-year-old woman, they were charging her $14,000 for 6 treatments for ovarian cancer. And of course, they pay Uncle Sam no royalties on these drug profits. So you see, it does get people pretty angry. And it not only gives them material to talk it up in their community, and there's anybody who wants to doubt the presence of corporate abuses, but it gets fire in their belly. It's not enough what we know, what's wrong in the country. The people who really do things, like the Occupy people, like Rosa Parks refusing to go to the rear of the bus in 1955 in segregated Montgomery, Alabama, like the sit-down strikers in the 1930s to form the UAW, they had fire in their belly. And that's what this book is designed. That's why it's called Getting Steamed to Overcome Corporatism.
Another issue that affects so many Americans, particularly financially, is overdraft fees from banks, which you also document in your book. Amazing that banks and credit unions collect tens of billions of dollars in overdraft fees. And you say that the cost of a bounced check to the bank is actually just $1.50, and that includes the cost of fraud losses. So many Americans end up overdrafting just because they've had overdraft fees, or they end up racking up debt because they've had one overdraft fee after another.
Or if they inadvertently bounce 5 checks, the bank doesn't cash it in the sequence that reduces the number of $30 charges for each. They do it so it maximizes the number. And
so they'll deposit the biggest check first.
Who agreed to this? Right. You see, all this fine print contracts are a form of contract peonage, contract serfdom. We sign these form contracts, and they're all rigged against us. They block us from going to court with compulsory arbitration. They have words that say that the seller, the bank, the insurance company, can change the contract any time unilaterally. That isn't a contract, but the courts enforce that kind of contract servitude. Underneath a lot of these abuses are these fine print contracts, and we've got a major project to challenge this entire massive corporate contract peonage and servitude on hundreds of millions of people around the world. And the website for that is faircontracts.org if you want to know more about it.
One other issue before we go into the aftermath of your book again is a simple demand of a transaction tax, which, given the economic state we're in today, could solve so many of the government's deficit problems. And this has been called a Robin Hood tax or Tobin tax by the Occupy movement. And this is just a tiny, tiny tax on speculation. But of course, Wall Street has blocked this tax, and Congress has upheld that blocking. But it would be such a simple thing to enact.
But the movement is growing. As you say, there are signs in the Occupy protests around the country, tax Wall Street gamblers, tax Wall Street speculators. You know, people go into stores. This is another thing that gets people upset when I say to them, you know, you go into stores and you buy necessities of life, you know, furniture, clothing, and so on. You pay 6 to 8% sales tax. But while you're in those stores, someone is buying $100 million worth of Exxon derivatives on Wall Street. They don't pay a penny sales tax. We had a sales tax on stock transactions as far away as the Civil War and in World War II and up to the 1981 when it was abolished. But now, of course, the volume is staggeringly higher, and so a tiny tax of less than 1% will raise over $350 billion. That's with a B. So if we want to tax things first, let's tax things we like the least or dislike the most, like speculation, like a carbon tax on pollution. And the book has very outrage-generating summaries of corporate abuses.
Well, the title of your book is Getting Steamed to Overcome Corporatism, and presumably you started working on this book more than 2 months ago since the Occupy movement has taken a hold. Are you seeing the country get steamed?
Yes. In fact, it's quite a coincidence this book came out. It's sort of like the Occupy movement's little paperback. I was working on it last year, and it came out just at the right time. And we're sending it around. I was just down speaking to the Occupy people at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., and we gave them some books for their little library there, and we're going to send some around the country.
Well, the recent news this year that the $5 a month charge that the Bank of America was getting ready to charge customers for debit cards, the fact that that they have stepped away from that charge, I mean, this would be the kind of thing you would have documented in your book had it happened in 2009, but it seems as though there was a small victory here, and is that an indication of Americans getting steamed?
It is, and it's an indication that Americans not only are losing their fear, which they respond to with apathy by showing up in these squares and marches, but they're beginning to realize they really have the power. I mean, the power of the people once organized is massively greater than these corporations. They'll run for cover. They'll beg for mercy. Once people get organized, once they take back their Congress, once they take back their regulatory agencies, once they move their money from the big banks to the small community banks and credit unions, once they start supporting these community economies like local energy and local community clinics and local farmer markets and local credit unions. I mean, it's immense. I mean, once they realize that, they're going to want more and more and more. Instead of just saying, oh, me, oh, my, you know, these corporations, these global corporations, just too powerful. You know, victims throughout history have limited their own power by convincing themselves that they're powerless.
Well, Ralph Nader, in your book, you discuss what you call corporate law and order, which is, I think, a very great a phrase, because it's so clear through your book that essentially we have a lawless country when it comes to corporations and the rights of corporations. And you outline 9 very specific things, such as abolishing corporate personhood, which perhaps could be 9 of many demands that the Occupy movement could make. And I know there's been some reluctance for the Occupy movement to embrace demands, but certainly do you think that these could be a very small part, at least, of a broader agenda?
Yeah, exactly. They're not detailed, so they're not going to start talking about, well, you know, how much is speculation tax on Wall Street, 0.03, 0.01, 0.3. They're at a specific level, but they're generally phrased, like larger law enforcement budgets for smarter crackdowns on corporate crime and broader facilities for workers, consumers, and taxpayers to band together, become power in their own rights. You know, new labor laws, getting rid of Taft-Hartley law, which restricts the rights of workers to unionize. More powers for investor shareholders. Let's face it, people have mutual funds. They don't have any power over these companies to say, send us back these dividends. You're sitting on $2 trillion, corporations outside the banking industry, $2 trillion, which they're using for stock buybacks or bonuses. Hey, that's the stockholders' money. It's our money. We want back in dividend checks so we can buy necessities of life. So that's what these are. They're on page 185, 190. The whole idea here is to make something very, very accurate, very readable, very compressible, and very conversational.
Ralph Nader, finally, you cite in the introduction to your book how you, in the 1950s and following that, got steamed after so many people you knew perished in auto accidents, which led you to be a pioneer of auto safety and pushing auto safety laws through Congress. So do you feel that that sort of informed this experiment that you're hoping to conduct through this book?
Very much so. When I was in high school and college, I lost friends in car crashes, and there were serious injuries. It was much more frequent then, when the cars were more dangerous. And I began looking into it in law school and wrote a paper, which I turned into Unsafe at Any Speed, the book, in 1965, which led to the motor vehicle and highway safety laws, which have saved over a million lives and tens of millions of injuries prevented or diminished. So I had that steamed. And I know in my interviews for the book, I interviewed people who knew a huge amount about unsafe automobile technology and safety systems that could replace it. They had a lot in their head, engineers and human factors specialists and scientists, but they didn't have fire in their belly. And it's that combination of cognitive knowledge and fire in your belly, which psychologists now have dressed up with the words emotional intelligence, they call it, that really gets people to break their routine, break out of their routine, band together, create movements, change the country and the world. We have so many problems in this country we don't deserve and so many solutions on the shelf that we don't apply. Just look at energy. Look at housing. Look at public transit. Look at better ways to heal people instead of unnecessary operations and dousing them with pharmaceuticals that backfire, different kinds of food systems, clean elections. But you can't do it if people don't spend, 2-3% of their discretionary time on their civic duties.
Well, Ralph Nader, finally, are you optimistic about the Occupy movement? Because a small section of American society that say they represent the 99% are not just spending their discretionary time, but all of their time at these encampments and really trying to point out economic injustice.
I think this is a historic movement. I don't think it's going to go away. It's being dispersed by a lot of police action in places from Oakland to New York, but that just disperses them into the neighborhoods and strengthens them and increases their number. Repression increases the level of resistance, and they're very smart. As long as they stay nonviolent, open civil disobedience, as their numbers grow, they'll exhaust the police resources. Just like in Albany, the police refused to come in because we don't have the resources for this. These people aren't bothering anybody. They rejected the order of the governor and the mayor in Albany, New York, a while back. So I think this is very important. I've been writing about it, and if your listeners would like to get my weekly column free electronically, just visit Nader.org. You'll get the latest copy of the article on the Occupy movement. Nader.org. Sign up. And you'll get automatically my weekly column. So I think the Occupy movement is breaking new ground. It's much more fundamental and I think very smart. It's not just a Saturday afternoon big march in Washington or Los Angeles or elsewhere. It's showing up and staying. And the pool of young people who are unemployed will simply be a huge reservoir of recruitment. By the ones who are already standing up for justice.
Well, Ralph Nader, we'll certainly link to Nader.org from our website. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you, and thank Pacifica.
I've been speaking with Ralph Nader about his latest book, Getting Steamed to Overcome Corporatism, Build It Together to Win. Again, you can find out more at Nader.org or check uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising, and after the short break, we will speak with Brian Dominick, longtime organizer, about tactics that occupy Wall Street. And then finally, the internet privacy issue with the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is better known now as the Internet Blacklist Bill. We'll find out why an array of forces are against it, all the way from Google to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Stay tuned.
KPFK would like to thank the following generous food donors for helping to feed our volunteers during our fall pledge drive. Tamika's Hot Cha-Cha Chili, Maggie's Morsels, Marina's Mediterranean Cuisine, the Union of Progressive Iranians, North Hollywood Ice on Craner, Western Bagel on Ventura and Studio City, Pete's Coffee on Lake in Pasadena, special shout out to Vanessa and the entire gang at Pete's, Nutiva Natural Snacks, Mountain Valley Water. When you visit these fine establishments, please thank them for donating to your favorite radio station, KPFK.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. When the call for a general strike in Oakland earlier this month led to a 10,000-strong march and a shutdown of the port, the actions of a handful of so-called Black Bloc anarchists who caused property damage triggered an age-old debate about tactics. Shop windows being smashed tend to attract almost as much media scrutiny as police brutality, sometimes more. The question of why there has not been a formal adoption of principles of nonviolence is being raised more often at the Occupy General Assemblies. While the majority of activists tend toward adopting nonviolence as a tactic, others take issue with the definition of violence itself. Writer and political cartoonist Ted Rall, author of the Anti-American Manifesto, takes a pragmatic view toward the necessity of violence in revolutions, saying, quote, "No meaningful political change has ever taken place without violence or the credible threat of violence." But others, like peace activist and author David Swanson, respond, saying, quote, "If violence were our only option, we'd certainly have to look into it, but I suspect organized violence would be even harder to bring forth than organized nonviolence." My guest, Brian Dominic, makes a compromise proposal that he recently published on Z Communications that rejects strict nonviolence, citing that Egyptian protesters in Tahrir Square defended themselves against police and military brutality and managed to win a revolution and international public sympathy. Dominic also rejects the notion that is sometimes expressed in the term diversity of tactics, whose advocates embrace the inevitability that a fringe of participants in all actions could branch off to smash windows. Instead, he drafts a detailed resolution that includes, among other things, a rejection of staged police arrests and its implications of acquiescence, and an acceptance of property damage only in the service of self-defense. Brian Dominic is a longtime organizer and street medic. He writes for ZNet. He also blogs at futureeconomy.com and now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Brian.
Hi, Sonali. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the most high-profile incident over the weekend that has raised the question of violence versus nonviolence is the issue for the incident at the campus of UC Davis over the weekend. A video of this incident where protesters were sitting peacefully with arms linked on the ground, clearly not posing any threat to police, were simply approached by policemen and pepper sprayed in the face. The video's gone viral, and it really brings up this issue of violence, who is responsible for it. In this case, clearly the violence was on the part of the police. How do you interpret what happened at UC Davis in terms of what it means for the Occupy movement?
Well, to me, the UC Davis video is just like so many that we've seen recently, except there's something that happens about 3 minutes into it. It's an eight and a half minute video. About 3 minutes into it, the entire scene changes radically from one where protesters who are passively sitting in, basically just exercising the most basic right, which is to appear and speak one's mind or be noticed and be heard. And they're severely brutalized, a little worse than we're used to seeing, not as bad as we've seen in some cases, but pretty awful. And then the rest of the protesters, 100 or maybe 200 people, are so outraged by what they see that they turn what was a passive resistance action by maybe a dozen or 20 people into an active resistance, nonviolent action by 100 or 200 in this crowd, who then start shaming the police with a chant of "shame on you," and then slowly force them off of campus without ever laying a hand on the police. But just by sheer mass, there's maybe a dozen cops, and the cops have to slowly back away because the protest turns into a very, very active but nonviolent form of resistance. And I think that this moment, if people pay attention to it and watch the full video, which almost nobody saw the full video, everyone's talking about the police brutality, but not the amazing response to it, I think this could be a symbol of what this movement is. We're no longer going to be victims of the police, but we don't need to use violence or smashing things to express our outrage. We can do it nonviolently, and I'm calling this a case of sort of counter-aggressive nonviolence, where the protesters aren't being aggressive. They're being aggressive in reaction to the police. They're still not using violence.
Well, how do you draw comparisons with Egypt? Because in Egypt, protesters, you know, from sitting here in the United States and watching the movement half a world away, what we know of it is that the organizers of the revolution in Egypt did adopt nonviolence as a philosophy and as a tactic, and it did work, but yet they weren't passive. When they were brutalized, they stood up for themselves. So what can we learn from that?
Yeah, and this goes back to the first Intifada, too. If you remember, it was a highly nonviolent strategy, very similar to Egypt's. But what happens is that there still needs to be what I think a lot of people find dignity in different forms, mm-hmm. and we find indignity in different forms. And to me, getting hit and not resisting in any way is undignified. It doesn't mean that I would tell someone else that they need to hit back or that they need to put up their arms to defend themselves or run or do whatever you know I might do. But I think that we are going to resist in different ways. And what we need is a compromise and sort of the range. It's still going to be a diversity of tactics. That term would still be applicable, I think. But we could limit some things and say, you know what, let's not hand ourselves over to the police. Let's stand for ourselves. And I think that what happened in Egypt was Egyptians and people around the world saw this as such a form of strength. And it wasn't the Gandhian, let them beat us, but it was still nonviolent for the most part in terms of the actual tactics on the ground. But, you know, if you're throwing rocks at me or shooting tear gas canisters at me, I might have to send the tear gas canisters back rather than sit here and let them, you know, poison my lungs while you stand there able to keep fighting.
But isn't there a danger of being provoked? Because sometimes police brutality is designed to provoke a reaction in activists, which is then used as a justification for arrest or further brutality.
Yeah, and this in a movement along the lines that I'm talking about is still a nonviolent civil disobedience movement that would require the types of trained discipline that has gone on for decades now in this country and around the world, where you're still going to have to practice this stuff. We're still going to have to talk about it. We're going to have to plan it. We're going to have a conscious, disciplined, nonviolent movement. So our reactions will still have to have limits. I just think that we could have a better mindset about it than the typical extremist pacifist or the, you know, black bloc anarchist stereotype of, you know, knee-jerk reactions.
Well, let's talk about the black bloc anarchist stereotype. I mentioned the Oakland incident, and for longtime activists and organizers, this has happened time and again, and it's always sparked debates. You have a group of people that have decided to have a plan, and it's a march, and there's no plan for even getting arrested necessarily, and a small group may split off. Sometimes they're covering their face, and they express the collective outrage of people in a way that is certainly not something that most people may approve of. In some cases, they may smash shop windows of corporate offices that do symbolize corporate greed. In other cases, they might smash windows of local store owners. But regardless, why is this a problematic set of actions for you?
Well, I would first like to say that I identify, out of everybody at the demonstrations, I think sometimes I identify most with the black bloc type folks. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of them have a similar background to me, and a lot of them have similar passions to me. But I can't get behind the tactic, because it's just so problematic. The tactic of smashing things wantonly, the tactic of wearing black masks even when everybody else isn't, I think that basically they're dressing like riot cops and behaving like riot cops, just towards the riot cops or towards property instead of towards the protesters. And I actually sometimes feel that they end up aligning more with the cops in this weird way than with the protesters. And I think the protesters very strongly feel that way, because at the very least, the black bloc is you know, giving what the cops and the corporate media will turn into an excuse to then go and attack nonviolent people. And I have a tremendous amount of experience with these types of demonstrations because I work as a street medic and have for about 11 or 12 years now since the global justice movements. I've seen it over and over again. And I've actually seen the black box work very effectively when they are engaging in sort of fast-moving but cooperative forms of nonviolent strategy and tactics on the ground that enhance the nonviolent activists who are on scene. And I've seen it go very badly, at least as often, probably more often, where they destroy property or somehow instigate the police, and then they disappear or meld into the crowd, and then the crowd has to take the repercussions of that. And I just don't think this tactic is ever going to be a seller, certainly not in this environment, with so many people inside the movement and so many observers outside just being grossed out by it. And I think that those folks need to compromise, and I think that seeing something like the crowd's response in the UC Davis situation could be the type of thing that makes the black blockers say, hey, you know what, we can still intimidate the police, we can still get our job done, we can still defend protesters or defend our space through mass nonviolence rather than these small groups of violent or property-destroying tactics.
Well, what you say in the piece that you wrote on ZNET, Pacifism and Diversity of Tactics, a Compromise Proposal, the resolution that you spell out is the kind of thing that a large number of people would have to really discuss and agree to. How important is it for the Occupy movement to adopt principles by which they conduct themselves? Because on the one hand, as I mentioned earlier, nonviolence is sort of broadly accepted, but it's vague and it doesn't outline what one can do in all situations, certainly not collectively as a group, as UC Davis students did. How important is it for there to be a formal discussion and adoption of tactics?
I think that there needs to be a cultural development, whether it needs to come from formal discussions or from just more low-key discussions and developing an understanding. I do think that any movement needs to have an identification with a form of basic, you know, a set of tactics, a toolbox of tactics. But I don't want to say, because I don't feel like I'm directly part of the Occupy movement. I feel like I have been a more integral in previous movements, and that for a lot of us, it's been important to step back and see how this develops and let folks do what they're doing. I give comments, but I don't feel like I'm participating. So I don't want to say too much other than that. I think that one of the biggest questions that Occupy is facing now that I see and I'm very excited about is how much of this street tactic stuff do we really need to do versus going back into the neighborhoods and developing institutions, alternative institutions that meet needs and this kind of thing that won't so much bring out issues of violence versus nonviolence, but what are the best ways to organize collectively institutions that can meet these needs?
Well,
so
that's true. Because
in a way, I don't want to get too caught up in this tactics discussion, because I almost want to see people in the streets less and doing more of the nitty-gritty work.
Well, certainly you're right in that the majority of encampments across the country, because of coordinated police action, have been dismantled. Here in Los Angeles, our encampment continues to grow, and there's been a unique relationship with the police. But there are still actions being planned every day. For example, on December 12th, there is to be a mass shutdown of ports, at least that's what's planned, on the entire West Coast, from the Bay Area down to here in Southern California, where we're broadcasting from. And in such instances, it does seem as though some level of planning for tactics needs to be made, because the last time Oakland saw this sort of thing, a lot of the news was focused, perhaps too much of it was focused on the window smashing rather than anything else. And certainly this is the kind of action here in Southern California that may provoke police action, even if the tent city hasn't.
Yeah, and I think that the Occupy movement took a big hit in public opinion because of the Oakland thing, which, of course, isn't representative of the Occupy movement.
Right.
Of course, it's ridiculous to blame a few people. But we are talking about the corporate media, especially with Fox News' influence. There's just no way around it. These things are going to have that effect. So anyone wishing to engage in those tactics has to accept stability, although they don't. And this is the problem, is that they wear masks and therefore they're totally unaccountable. But they need to accept the responsibility that they are handing this new narrative this awful narrative to the media that, you know, this is a movement of people who want to trash property or who want to put everybody else around them at risk. And the point of my piece that I wrote was basically, look, we do need some sort of understanding. I think all movements do need this. And the thing that needs to happen is it needs to be something that only the very most outliers would oppose. So we're accepting active resistance of many forms as long as they don't engage in property destruction except when it's absolutely necessary, for instance, to build barricades. And it's not fighting back against police, except you should be able, I think, to swarm police and pull someone who they've arrested out of their grasp. I've seen this happen. It's extremely empowering for the protesters, and I've never actually seen a cop get hurt in the process.
So like unarresting people, basically.
Unarresting, exactly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the pacifists on the far end of pacifism, they need to make some compromises too. And I think that this tactic of negotiating with them, saying, call out our names or call us by number one by one, and we'll walk over to you and hold out our hands so you can arrest us, I think that that has to go. And I think that as more and more people watch some of the tactics that are traditional left tactics that have been engaged in for a long time by civil disobedience people, they're not inspiring to the rest of us. They're not inspiring to working class folks who don't want to come with sticks and Molotov cocktails to fight cops, but who don't want to come just to get beat up or just to be arrested and then processed and released or whatever and go through some sort of, you know, ceremonial arrest process. This is, we're playing for keeps now. This isn't symbolic anymore. And I think that that's one of the most amazing things about this movement, is that the symbolism has eroded in a way, and people are in the streets saying this is for keeps this time.
Well, Brian Dominic, we will link to your article with the detailed resolution you suggest from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today, as well as to your blog. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Sonali.
Brian Dominic is a longtime organizer and street medic. He writes for ZNet and blogs at futureeconomy.com. We've been talking about tactics in the Occupy movement. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll take a look at the Stop Online Piracy Act, why it's being dubbed the Internet Blacklist Bill. Stay tuned.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
His mama was a weeping willow. His daddy wished he did the same thing years ago. When he was young, he played the drums, open for Artie Shaw. Wanted to be a jazz legend and a superstar. But his dreams faded when they had little David. He secretly resented all his friends that made it. And to be honest, grew to hate and love his own son. And couldn't understand where the rage was coming from. Davy and his mama was on tiptoes, cause I never knew which daddy would open the door. Either the mad, sad, happy, or the drunk one. Davy liked the drunk, it was the only time he spoke to him. He sat down and yelled for a cause light. Davy brought it for him, it was the only thing he did right.
Davy Rocket by Pigeon John. Find out more at pigeonjohn.com or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Before we go to our last segment, I just want to remind you that tickets for our Wednesday, November 30th Gabor Mate event are still available at uprisingradio.org. It's a fundraiser for KPFK. And it's happening Wednesday, November 30th at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. The acclaimed physician, best-selling author Gabor Mate. We're flying him to Los Angeles for this event. We're very excited about it. We hope you can join. There's going to be a reception at 6 p.m. and the event with general admission at 7 p.m. So there are two levels of tickets that you can get at uprisingradio.org. This is Uprising, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Internet piracy has not ceased to boil the blood of entertainment industry heavyweights since Napster allowed nominally savvy users to widely share music online without a penny going back to major record labels. The distributors of movies and music, largely located in Hollywood, have not adapted to the new age of information sharing. Instead, they continue to lobby for legislation to restrict the ability of internet users to consume their content online for free. Two bills under consideration in the House and the Senate are born of this tension between new media and old, the better known as the House's Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA. SOPA, introduced by Texas Congressman Lamar Smith, ostensibly targets foreign, quote, rogue sites that distribute U.S. content in China and elsewhere. U.S. companies have few effective legal options to regulate foreign practices. SOPA would allow extrajudicial action if an intellectual property rights holder claims a website is infringing on a copyright. Without a hearing before a judge or a court order, payment processors for websites and advertisers could be given 5 days to stop business with the alleged rogue website. The intellectual property holder only needs to notify the companies that they're supporting a website engaging in copyright infringement. SOPA also allows the Department of Justice to blacklist an entire website by preventing access to it through its domain name. Website owners have few opportunities to contest allegations of copyright infringement. Opponents of SOPA say its vague language will allow interference with U.S.-based websites and decry its broad-stroke approach of disabling an entire website instead of removing only single pieces of offending content. Google, Yahoo, and Facebook have come out against SOPA, as well as many internet advocacy groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation. My guest is Holmes Wilson. He's a co-founder of Fight for the Future, an advocacy organization against internet censorship. Welcome to Uprising, Holmes.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the details of this bill itself. How easy would it be if this bill were to pass and signed into law? How easy would it be for websites that offend some section of Congress or corporations, for example, websites like WikiLeaks, to be simply blocked from most users?
Well, I think it's very easy. The website can be blocked if the government decides that there's some portion of it that is infringing. That can be as little as a few links, and it can be links posted not by the website itself, but by the site's users. And when you think of the social media landscape where, you know, the most important sites online are posts where users are places where users post material. So the sites that are most crucial to any movement are the places that are most vulnerable to this type of takedown order, because they can be taken down just for a link or two posted by a user.
Now, isn't it true that already there are mechanisms for the government to address content that they consider problematic, whether or not advocates of internet freedom agree with those? Aren't there already legal mechanisms in place?
Yes, there are. Any copyright holder in the U.S. has the right with any company in the U.S. to take down specific pieces of content. They just have to say, that is ours. We request that you take it down. And if the site complies with that quickly, the site is not liable, and the publisher is happy because the material was removed, or the copyright holder is happy because the material was removed. So there is that mechanism. And then there's also a more controversial mechanism, which has created massive problems. But the Customs Enforcement Division of Homeland Security is allowed, or has been, using sort of dubious authority to seize domain names as well. So they can already do that for sites outside of the U.S. But when they do, they've used a terrible blanket approach and have often shut down sites that have nothing to do with copyright infringement.
Does this bill specifically address copyright infringement and not, for example, exposing government secrets like WikiLeaks?
No, it is extremely broad. It's not just about copyright. It can be a copyright claim, a patent claim, a trademark claim, or even a right of celebrity claim, like a celebrity saying that their photo was misused or something like that. So it's extremely broad. And to use the example of WikiLeaks, the provisions of the bill that pertain not to site blocking, but to cutting off the site's sources of revenue, advertising, PayPal donations, those provisions are so broad that any corporation in the U.S. would be able to, within 5 days, cut off any site from all of their donations, all of their revenue, just with a claim, without a court order, without anything. And if the site responded and said, there was no infringement, this is a legit, we are a legitimate site, the payment processors would have no obligation to reinstate them. So this law would basically give, you know, if you look at the treatment that WikiLeaks got from the U.S. government, this law gives every corporation in the United States a very, very simple mechanism to do that to any site.
Right, because in the case of WikiLeaks, the government went to great lengths to persuade companies like PayPal, et cetera, to dissociate from WikiLeaks. And there was a lot of effort to make it happen. But it did happen, and it was up to the compliance of the companies. If this law were to pass, it would essentially force companies. Mm-hmm. And is that why major companies like Google and Facebook, who aren't necessarily friends of internet freedom advocates, particularly when it comes to privacy issues, but is that why these major companies are also against this bill, because they don't want to be hamstrung?
Well, anyone who's ever made a website or ever run an internet service is against this bill, because it overturns the past 10 years of legal policy around copyright and the internet, which was this idea that if a site dutifully took down material that was pointed out as infringing, it would not be liable. And without that, I mean, if you imagine an internet where everybody is liable for anything, even if it's stuff that the users post, you can't be an ISP, you can't run a forum, you can't be Facebook, you can't be YouTube, because you could get sued for any little thing that anybody posted. And those circumstances would just basically invalidate the whole idea of a social media website where people can speak freely.
And of course, this affects people who are very much part of the new media landscape, bloggers, Pacifica Radio, I mean, our website, uprisingradio.org, any website that is, that has challenging material on it could be targeted. Well, is there any support aside from members of Congress who are sponsoring this? Are they corporate backers of this bill?
Yes, there is a tremendous amount of support for this bill. In fact, I think everyone listening should consider this bill still as more likely to pass than not. The Chamber of Commerce is fully behind it, and it's been, you know, doing member fly-ins, pushing it really hard. The drug companies are for it because they want the ability to block Canadian pharmacies with access to purchase affordable drugs from a country that has a more kind of sensical healthcare system. A lot of manufacturers and fashion companies like are really for it because they hate that somebody could buy a bag that says Louis Vuitton on it that isn't Louis Vuitton. And so they are pushing that really hard. And this is sort of tragic. Some of the unions that are involved in the entertainment industry are also for it, because they have been kind of brought along for the ride by the big media companies.
Now, Holmes, some critics say that even issues of copyright infringement wouldn't actually be stopped by this bill. You mentioned entertainment unions. Is it true?
Yeah.
Would this bill actually be effective at stopping copyright infringement?
Well, nothing's going to. I mean, whenever people can speak freely, some people are going to use that freedom to post a video or a link or a song. And I think there's no way to, if you're talking about definitively stopping copyright infringement and an internet where copyright infringement doesn't exist, you're talking about an internet where no one has the ability to speak freely. And that's the end of the story. In terms of the provisions that the bill has for blocking sites, for example, there are ways around that. But it would have an impact. I mean, if this bill passes, there are going to be sites that you use every day, sites like Dropbox or SoundCloud. You're going to go to them, and there's going to be a message from the government that says you are no longer allowed to go to this site because you're an American on American soil.
My guest is Holmes Wilson, co-founder of of Fight for the Future, which is an advocacy organization against internet censorship. We're talking about the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA. It's been dubbed the Internet Blacklist Bill by opponents. Well, let's talk about the politics involved. There's a House version. I'm assuming there's a Senate version as well, or is that yet to be introduced?
Now, the Senate version was introduced several months ago. It's called the Protect IP Act. And yeah, both the House and the Senate version have significant support from both parties.
And I understand that there were congressional hearings that began last week. The first day was November 16th. Are there more hearings planned, and are those places where advocates of internet freedom can express themselves?
There are more hearings planned. Anyone who is concerned about this bill should contact their representatives immediately. This bill's moving very fast, and both in the House and in the Senate.
Now, I understand there is a little bit of opposition in Congress. For example, Nancy Pelosi has come out against it, and even Republican Daryl Issa has come out against the Stop Online Piracy Act. Is there some sense that that enough opposition could build in Congress?
I think so. I think if this becomes controversial enough, the more controversial it becomes, the more outcry there is, the more people spread the word, the slower the bill will move. But there is really the danger that there is one danger here that's very significant, which is that some of the biggest industries opposing the bill are technology companies that are scared of the tremendous amount of lawsuits that this bill will bring them if it passes.
And it's amazing. Go ahead.
If legislators find a way to reduce that liability, but maintain the provisions that allow the government or corporations to block any website or cut off sources of funding, if they figure out a way to kind of thread that needle, then we could lose. The danger is that all the corporations will agree this is a good bill and Congress will pass it, and the public interest organizations will say, "Hey, wait a second, but."
So you're saying that this bill can't be reformed, has to be rejected outright?
Yeah, I mean, the key provisions are, the key idea in this bill is the ability of the government and corporations to block websites entirely for some subset of that site having infringing stuff maybe posted by users. And that's just a recipe for disaster.
Well, Holmes, we often criticize China for having a censored internet. If this bill were to pass, would we see a similar thing in the U.S.?
Well, I think there are significant foreign policy implications for this bill. I mean, you have Hillary Clinton, you have Biden going around the world speaking about the evils of regimes that censor their citizens' access to the internet. And then with the U.S., putting in place at least a system that's very structural. I mean, the rationale for it is different, but the structure of it is the same. it really does undermine our message to the world that internet censorship is wrong. And I think it gives a bunch of countries, many countries that are maybe on the fence and that maybe are considering systems like this, a pretext to do so. And it really does weaken the case.
Well,
America's case against.
Well, Holmes Wilson, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and helping us helping sound the alarm about this bill.
All right. Thank you very much.
Holmes Wilson is co-founder of Fight for the Future, an advocacy organization against internet censorship. And you can find out more at their website, fightforthefuture.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Jeremy Bentham once said, "As to the evil which results from censorship, it is impossible to measure it, for it is impossible to tell where it ends." And that's Jeremy Bentham. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can find all of the links that we mentioned on the air, as well as local events and other information. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kulhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8:00.